Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Why are women underrepresented in elite scientific institutions, even as they earn more than half the science undergraduate degrees in the United States? My guest today has not only observed the problem of gender inequity in U.S. university labs and science departments, she has lived them, starting early in her career when her bosses felt it was appropriate to make recommendations and assumptions for her career based in part on her decision to marry and have children while she worked. While bias is less overt today, she is still deeply concerned about the fact that men are vastly more likely than women to hold tenured positions in scientific and mathematical fields, and she says correcting the imbalance will take concerted effort by both women and men. Sue V. Rosser is Provost and Vice President for Academic Affairs and Professor of Women's and Gender Studies and Sociology at San Francisco State University. Her new book is called Breaking Into the Lab: Engineering Progress for Women in Science. Sue, welcome to Think.
Thank you, Chris.
Let's start by talking about just how male-dominated certain scientific disciplines are. I have to tell you, I was astonished by the table you put, I think, on page 9 of the book that shows that as of 2006, only 16.2% of all full professors in science and engineering at U.S. universities are women, even though those women are earning more than half the undergraduate degrees in science.
Yes, that's right. And it varies tremendously both by the particular discipline in science and also by the type of institution. For example, in certain fields in science, and I'm using the definition that the National Science Foundation does, which includes social sciences, there are, in certain fields such as psychology, there are actually quite a few women. For example, 29.7% of the full professors in psychology are women. In contrast, at the other end and extreme are engineering and computer science. Mm-hmm. In engineering, only 4.1% of the full professors are women.
So one out of 25.
Exactly. Yeah. Also, it varies by the type of institution. So the more elite or research-one institutions tend to have many fewer women as tenured full professors, less than 10% overall in science and engineering. Whereas the more teaching-oriented institutions, which are seen as less prestigious in the field, in terms of research and that sort of thing, have more women. And then two-year institutions, community colleges, have higher percentages of women. So it varies both by discipline and by type of institution.
And in the life and social sciences, where women are better represented than in physical science, you remind us that tenure positions in those fields are actually falling across the board, so they are not the ideal route necessarily to career stability and growth for women who want to stay in academia.
Well, that's right. Unfortunately, one of the facts of higher education these days, particularly public higher education, is that fewer and fewer tenure-track positions are being hired overall because of the budget constraints, with universities resorting to more what are called lecturers, adjuncts, sometimes transient faculty positions, so that these are people who sometimes teach at more than one institution, and this provides flexibility for the institution to let those people go when the budget gets tight. They don't have the protection of tenure. So it's not very good for the individuals themselves, and actually it's no way to build an academic institution. But the current budget situation has really forced that at the public higher education institutions, where the bulk of students are getting their education.
So, Sue, clearly this issue matters to women who desire science careers. But tell us, though, why it matters to the quality of science overall to have gender equity in the lab.
Well, I'm really glad that you asked that question, Chris, because sometimes people just get hung up in what I call the bean counting, looking at the numbers,
yeah.
You know, what difference does that make? And that is important. It's important for equity. It's important for women themselves because, as you know, in this scientific and technological society, the better paying jobs are actually in science and technology. So one reason for the wage gap between men and women overall, which has remained for decades and decades now, is that the men tend to go into areas that are heavy in science and technology where the salaries are better. And women who go into those areas actually do quite well compared to women who go into other service professions. So that's, that equity issue I don't mean to underplay. But it is important, in my opinion, for another reason, which is that people who have different experiences and different backgrounds are likely to see problems and find solutions in a little different way than other individuals. For example, Shirley Malcolm from AAAS, American Association for Advancement of Science, has always pointed out what would happen if there had been a woman on the airbag design team. Would that fiasco have been prevented? Now, is there something about being a woman that makes you think, oh, is this going to have an effect on shorter people or smaller people? Not really, except for the fact that on the average, women are shorter than men, and there are a higher percentage of short women in the population. So maybe somebody who's had trouble, you know, reaching for the top shelf or something is very conscious of height and might think, gosh, what would be the impact of this? Similarly, when you think about what happened with cardiovascular research, I'm old enough that I remember back in the period of the 1960s and before when all research trials for cardiovascular disease were run on men. Now, there were good reasons for this. People were feared, and pharmaceutical companies still do to a certain extent, testing a drug in a woman of childbearing age because they're afraid if she gives birth to a deformed fetus that this will, of course, lead to litigation against them. However, the truth is that when the drugs come on the market, they're going to be taken by both men and women. And so if it has a differential effect in men and women, it won't show up if the tests have only been run on men. So this was what happened with research up through the 70s until we started lobbying to have women included in experimental trials of drugs. And because of that, a lot of the techniques that had been developed before that time, for example, the research that led to angioplasty, to bypass surgery and everything, had been pioneered using men. And this meant that when it was first tested on women, it didn't work as well. There were higher death rates in women than men. Not surprising, because women overall have slightly smaller vessels than the men upon whom these techniques were pioneered. And so sometimes when people ask me, why does gender make a difference for science and engineering, I say it's really a matter of life or death. We had women presenting in at emergency rooms in the 1960s with symptoms of heart attack that were not recognized, because now we know today, since women have been included in trials and so on, that often the symptoms manifest differently in women than men for cardiovascular disease. But for a long period of time, the symptoms were not being detected as well in women as they were in men, because the studies had been done in men only.
You were actually in the room, Sue, and I think it was 2005 when former Harvard President Larry Summers made his infamous remarks about underrepresentation of women in science. Can you remind us, first of all, of what he said?
Yes, okay. Yes, that was a very interesting and profound day, actually. About 40 of us had been invited to this conference at Harvard University. And we were all specialists in gender and science research. And at noon, President Larry Summers, who was then the president of Harvard University, came over to give a speech to us. And, of course, we were excited about his presence. But then we began to be a little alarmed as he made his, you know, one-hour prepared speech followed by about 20 minutes of questions. And the main points he made that particularly astounded people were, first of all, he said that women are unwilling or unable to work the 80-hour weeks required for success in science at top-flight academic institutions. He said this as an explanation for why there was a gender gap in terms of the numbers of women in science compared to men and the numbers of famous women scientists. So that was the first thing that he said. Second thing he said was that innate or biological factors rather than socialization probably accounted for sex differences in the mathematical aptitude and also for adult preferences for choice of academic study and occupational field. And then the third point he made, which actually did not receive as much publicity in the media and the press, was that when the reason that there wasn't any kind of discrimination against women in science had to do with the fact that market forces would really prevent that from happening. He said that discrimination is a taste for hiring people like oneself. And he said that doesn't exist in academia because that would be eliminated through market forces by lesser institutions hiring highly qualified women and minorities, thereby gaining a competitive advantage. So we were all quite shocked by his remarks and began to ask him questions about it, particularly since the papers that were presented there, of course, very much gave different reasons and facts, and some of the research had been done by people on his own faculty there at Harvard. And so it was quite an interesting controversy that was touched off by that. Although people mostly were against what he had to say, and we heard from folks all around the world about that conference. Emails started pouring in immediately when word got out as to what he had said, and most were astounded that the president of what many people view as certainly the most prestigious institution in this country, if not in the world, would make such remarks. On the other hand, some people thought he was right, and they agreed with him. The very least that can be said is that for those of us who do research in this field, he brought tremendous attention to the issues of women in science. And for that, we will always be eternally grateful.
Well, Sue, let's unpack some of those things. Let's start with the 80-hour weeks that he said women were unwilling or unable to work. First of all, is it always an 80-hour week for male scientists who reach the top of their professions?
Well, no, I don't think it is always an 80-hour week for male scientists who reach the top of their profession. There are many examples of individuals who, what you might call, work smart. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of question about whether all that face time has to occur. There's this kind of mythology in science that unless you're in the lab for very long hours, you cannot possibly be a dedicated scientist and will therefore not make the really important discoveries. Of course, there's tremendous variation about that from field to field. Some areas are much more theoretical and people don't have to be in the laboratory at all, or they have to, you know, the main thing is they can be thinking about what they're doing. So they could be home doing the dishes or mowing the lawn or changing the baby or whatever and have their minds on their work. And I think that goes on for a lot of individuals. Other folks have suggested that often there's time wasted. I'm sure you all know people at work who, you know, they're there a long period of time, but there's a big question about what they're doing while they're there.
Sounds like the ideal place for us to take a quick break. I will not comment on that, but my guest this hour is Sue V. Rosser. She's Provost and Vice President for Academic Affairs, and she's Professor of Women's and Gender Studies and Sociology at San Francisco State University. We're talking this hour about her new book, Breaking Into the Lab: Engineering Progress for Women in Science. If you'd like to join the conversation, we've got lines open at 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in financial planning, web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. And you can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Provost and Vice President for Academic Affairs and Professor of Women's and Gender Studies and Sociology at San Francisco State University, Sue V. Rosser. Her new book is called Breaking into the Lab, Engineering Progress for Women in Science. You can join the conversation at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Sue, going back to looking at these statements that were made by Larry Summers, there's this question of biological aptitude, and perhaps we can explain the reason there are more men at the highest echelons of elite institutions in the physical sciences in particular, based on, perhaps different brain chemistry. Certainly, as a scientist, you acknowledge that this is something that ought to be explored.
Well, absolutely. As you may know, but probably members of the audience don't necessarily know, I do have a PhD in biology. And so, I have looked somewhat at the evidence for this, although this is not my own area of expertise. And I would never deny the possibility of biological differences between men and women. And certainly there is quite a bit of evidence of different brain organization, perhaps, and some functional differences. However, I think to explain these discrepancies, that's really not needed because we have quite a bit of evidence that beginning very early on, even at birth, parents and others in society react to people very differently depending upon whether they think the individual is a male or a female. So, there have been these studies done where they take a newborn baby and they dress it in yellow clothing and give it an ambiguous name such as Chris, and they tell one group of people that Chris is a boy and another group of people that Chris is a girl, and the ones they tell that Chris is a boy tend to describe him as larger. They tend to present him with visual objects more. They tend to talk to him about being stronger and, see him that way. Whereas those who are told that Chris is a girl, they tend to speak with her more. They tend to see her as more delicate and, describe her as pretty and this kind of thing. So even beginning immediately at birth, there are very different reactions of people to a baby based upon the supposed gender, and that sets in motion, I think, a whole series of gender differences that are reinforced constantly by our society. As a grandmother, I have to say that I now have three grandsons, and I'm always shocked when I go into the store to buy them clothing to see this whole, about two-thirds of the store is pink and purple, which is clearly supposed to be the clothing for girls. And then there's this other side of the store that has these sort of browns and blues and greens and sports. I mean, it's very, very differentiated, perhaps even more so than when my own kids were young.
Yeah, and you make the point that when you were growing up, there were girls who maybe honestly thought they had no interest in sports, but this was before Title IX,
right,
when there wasn't much available to them anyway.
That's exactly right. And so there's a lot of question about whether if girls were encouraged very much in the same ways and pushed in the same ways in science and engineering as boys are, whether they would become interested. Because now the argument has kind of changed to this is a choice issue. Girls and women are choosing not to go into science and engineering. They are not choosing these careers. But honestly, when I was in junior high and elementary school and high school, which were the pre-Title IX days, no secret, I've already revealed that I'm a grandma, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it's not surprising, the time frame here. It was not thought of that girls would do sports at the level that they do today. And there were not the women's athletic teams at the universities, the scholarships available. It was not encouraged in that way. And so most girls shied away from it. For heaven's sakes, we played basketball where, there were only the two dribbles on the court. So very different kind of development. therefore it could be possible, and I believe we have some evidence to that effect, that it would be a different situation if women were encouraged in the same way going into mathematics and science at a very early age. And indeed, we've seen in some very complicated and scientifically based fields that now women are entering at a more rapid rate than men, for example, in medicine.
Yeah. You are, this is a book about research, but you're also candid about some of your own experiences, particularly early in your career. And I have to tell you, they are stunning. You had one advisor tell you that you ought to have an abortion because it wasn't a good time for the research for you to have a baby.
Absolutely. So this was in 1974. I was doing a postdoc, and I got pregnant with my second child. And the professor with whom I was working said that I needed to get an abortion because it was the wrong time in the research. We needed to get more data so that we could get the grant renewed.
What do you say to this?
Well, I was stunned. I was very shocked that he suggested this, and I really went home and, you know, discussed it and thought about it and decided not to do that.
But you actually thought about it based on this recommendation.
Well, I did. You know, it was shocking. First of all, you have to recall that just the year before, in 1973, abortion had become legal in this country. So it was something that was kind of out there in the culture, but not quite in the way it is now, where it's been very polarized, and I think no one would ever say that in a work environment now. But he actually said this, and I thought, well, and then I decided, no, I'm not, certainly not going to do that. And then I particularly thought about it because I did become quite sick with a really bad cold and flu that I couldn't shake. And I thought, oh my gosh, what if something is wrong then with this baby and everything? And I remember asking the doctor, do you think there's anything that maybe something should be? He said, no, I think she'll be fine. But didn't say she. We didn't know at that point that it would be a girl. And I didn't have amniocentesis or anything. And he said, I think that the baby will just be small. Well, I'm very happy to say today that I think that I made the right decision. She's a physician. Mm-hmm. She went to Harvard as an undergraduate, actually, and is now also at UCSF on the faculty and head of the women's clinic at the VA. So, and she has two little boys. So I'm very happy both from a personal point of view and I think from a societal point of view it was the right decision. But it was shocking to me at the time.
So what's really interesting, Sue, is that the things that seem to stand in the way of women's progress today are perhaps different than they were for you in 1974 and subtler, but they're still there. One of the things you identify, and you'll have to explain the reasons for this, is that most elite women scientists in academia happen to also be married to male scientists, and the converse is not true for men. Can you talk about why that makes a difference?
Sure. Well, I don't know that most elite women scientists, but
many
are married to men scientists. Well, there are a few things that may go on there that may make a difference. One issue is that there's substantial evidence that men and women scientists have access to different networks. Men scientists have networks that include a larger number of individuals and a larger number of famous individuals on the whole. Mm-hmm. Of course, there are exceptions to this. Whereas women's networks tend to include more women and to include more junior men, who, of course, tend to be less famous. And so what's thought that happens with women scientists who are married to outstanding men scientists is that, of course, because of social events at dinners, conferences, those sorts of things, they get exposure to this wider network that's also provided them by their husbands' networks as a scientist. So they have their own networks that they've developed, plus they have exposure to his in a way that a woman who is single or not partnered or married to a scientist would not have that kind of access. So that may be one of the factors that makes a difference. A second factor is that often these couples have met during graduate school and are in related fields, and they work together as a team. And although this can have some negative consequences, it can also have some very positive consequences in that their life really becomes very much their science and what they're doing, and they can make this all work together very well. Now, the reason, of course, that very few men scientists have this situation is the numerical disparities that we've been talking about.
Right.
There just aren't that many women scientists. So if the men scientists then wouldn't be married if that were the case, because there just aren't as many women scientists there for them to marry.
So we seem to be doing a really good job, based on the numbers, at getting women through undergraduate science and engineering and mathematics degrees. Why do they drop off first at the master's level and then ultimately in a far greater percentage at the PhD level?
Well, I'm really glad you asked that question, because often people look at the difference between what the statistics were in the late 1960s or 1970s and now, and they think the problem is solved. Mm-hmm. Because it is true, we have made tremendous strides over the years in getting women so that they now receive half of all undergraduate degrees in science and engineering. As I mentioned previously, there is a large disparity among disciplines. And I would like to point out that, for example, in engineering and computer science, still less than 20% of undergraduate degrees go to women. Computer science is an interesting case, because actually the peak of women receiving computer science degrees was in the mid-1980s, when about 37-38% of computer science undergraduate degrees went to women. It has dropped precipitously, not only in this country, but in Europe as well. And so now only about 17-18% of computer science degrees go to women. But in general, with those exceptions, over the years, the numbers and percentages of women in fields has gone up. But there is attrition at every level. So although women are getting more than half of women of science and engineering degrees at the undergraduate level, it drops off a fair amount at the master's degree level, even more at the PhD degree level. And then when you start to get into the workforce and go up through the ranks, there's attrition at each level.
Hmm.
Some people look at these data and say, oh, well, over time, it'll be fixed. It's because, you know, there are not enough people coming into the pipeline. But there's actually quite a bit of evidence that without a considerable change in some of the institutional practices and conscious efforts at each level, that it won't be corrected over time. Because that just hasn't been the way things have gone in many of the disciplines.
In many fields where women or people of color are underrepresented, there's a concerted effort to make sure that these individuals get into higher positions and administrative positions. You recognize that that's important, but you say women scientists should not do this, should not make the mistake of doing this too early in their careers.
Yes, absolutely. I have a chapter in the book where I talk about why senior women scientists make good academic administrators at the positions at the level of dean, provost, VP for research, president, and so on. And in fact, that's another area where women have increased. In the last 20 years, we've gone from having about 9%, for example, presidents of universities being women, to now it's a little over 25% of American universities are headed by women. However, a cautionary tale is the one that you mentioned. Sometimes women go into administrative positions too early in their careers, and they might take an associate position. So, for example, a woman who is an associate professor might be encouraged to become associate chair of her department, or associate dean, or associate provost. And there are a couple of problems with this. First of all, because those positions are very demanding from an administrative point of view, the person probably won't have much time to do her research. This would be the case if a man took that position too.
Right.
But it's more often women that are encouraged to do that because there is a desire of universities, of course, to have more women in these positions. I might say a similar thing can happen to men of color because of the desire to have racial diversity in administrative positions. So they get in there, they do the job, they do that job well, but whoops, their research career has stopped. So they don't develop the curriculum vitae that they need in terms of publications and so on to get promoted to full professor. Then, ironically, what happens is that short-circuits their ability also to reach the highest administrative level positions. Because for the top positions at most institutions, of course, they want full professors. You want a full professor to be the dean. You want a full professor to be the provost. You want a full professor to be the president, although these days there are exceptions to that because we hire lawyers and various other kinds of folks with different backgrounds to be presidents. But that's the usual career track. So that can be a real trap. And I have to say that as an administrator myself, although I'm, of course, eager to get women and also men of color into those positions, I do try to think about the fact that if they go into them too soon without reaching full rank, it will really not only hurt their career as scientists, but also ultimately short-circuit their career as administrators.
Another irony is that research grants reserved specifically for women scientists as a sort of remedy to the problems that we've been discussing can sometimes be a source of resentment to women scientists by their male colleagues.
Yes, you know, that has been a critique that was leveled, first of all, at some of the grants that were handed out at the National Science Foundation. In the mid-1990s, I was senior program officer for women's programs at the National Science Foundation in Washington. And in my portfolio, we had what were called visiting professorships for women, and that ultimately morphed into professional opportunities for women in research and education, or power awards. And I have studied those awardees for a long time. One of the things they reported was that was often seen as a women's grant, and it wasn't valued as highly. A similar thing happened with the Claire Booth Luce Professorship.
Let me jump in here and so you can have time to finish the whole thing after the break. My guest is Sue V. Rosser, Provost and Vice President for Academic Affairs and Professor of Women's and Gender Studies and Sociology at San Francisco State University. We're talking about her new book, Breaking Into the Lab, Engineering Progress for Women in Science. We'll be back in 2 minutes.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. You can enrich your career with new certificate programs in financial planning, web design, graphic design, and paralegal studies. And you can learn more at smu.edu/CAPE.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Sue V. Rosser. She's Provost and Vice President for Academic Affairs and Professor of Women's and Gender Studies and Sociology at San Francisco State University. Her new book is called Breaking Into the Lab, Engineering Progress for Women in Science. You can join us by calling 1-800-933-5372, or you can send email to think@kera.org. And Sue, before the break, you were talking about the example of the Claire Booth Luce professorships.
Yes, these are professorships that are given on the basis of merit to women faculty as assistant professors. They've been given to people mostly at private institutions, although a few at public institutions. And the power awardees went mostly to women at public institutions, although a few at private institutions. So I've studied both of these groups of women. They tended to be very successful in their careers, but both groups noted that often their male colleagues resented their having received these grants because they felt they were given an unfair advantage since the men could not apply for them. There was a lot of scuttlebutt that, the power awards were easier to get than a traditional NSF award. We ran some data and found, in fact, that they were more competitive. At that time, at National Science Foundation, it was about 33% of NSF grants were funded for power awardees. It was more like 22%. So this would suggest that they were, in fact, more competitive. But there was some what you might call professional jealousy or annoyance on the part of men for these targeted awards.
And we should make the point here that you are not necessarily saying that all men in science are trying to keep women out and sort of barring the door, but there are sometimes accidental advantages conferred by being male. And one of them is something as simple and easy to overlook as opportunities for socialization with one's colleagues.
Yes, absolutely. And I would like to say that I think most men scientists are not trying to keep women out. And in fact, a lot of them have really gone out of their way to encourage women. And you can see examples of men who have really mentored women scientists, who have a whole flock of women scientists that, in fact, they've produced in a particular field. For example, Elizabeth Blackburn, when she received the Nobel Prize, talked about how her mentor had encouraged women, and because of that, there were about 50% of the researchers in telomere research were women, and that's the way it should be in all fields. So that makes a big difference. However, often, because there are large numbers of men in a particular field, there's a certain kind of social exclusion that can occur. For example, if the lab has a habit of playing, softball or some kind of sports activity, which sometimes labs do, and then afterwards in the locker room, there's a certain kind of conversation that goes on, and, it turns to the science just kind of accidentally, that would probably mean that the men who are in the locker room with the male professor who heads the lab can have that conversation. And women will be excluded simply because they're not there. Nothing intentional, but it's just like you could say that, I guess, my women faculty have some kind of access to me that men don't have because they run into me sometimes in the restroom and they'll ask me a question. They'll say, I wanted to ask you, what about, it's maybe a minor point, not worth making an appointment to go see the provost about, but if you run into her in the restroom, hey, you might ask her about that. And I think a similar kind of thing happens with men scientists who have a kind of access to the male leaders of the lab or sometimes the leaders of the institution who tend to be men.
So you mentioned Liz Blackburn having been mentored by a male scientist, and you actually think that men, because they are the majority of a lot of these elite labs, need to take an active role in this and will ultimately be part of the solution if one is created. Are there special kinds of sensitivities or mentoring required for women as opposed to simply another male colleague?
Well, I think it's a very tricky area, and one reason I wrote this book was I did want to reach the male mentors as well as the women scientists. And in the book, I outline, as you indicated, some of the experiences that happened to me, but I also have interviews with other women scientists who document their experiences. And some of those were maybe unintentional but negative mentors who were male. Some of them were positive mentors who were male, and I hope through the interviews to show, what can happen. So an example of what you were talking about is a physicist who talked about the fact that she had had all male mentors through her undergraduate school, graduate school, postdoc. But they had been very positive, very encouraging, really boosted her career. When she got to her university tenure track position, her faculty mentor encouraged her to come up for early tenure. the other faculty were angry about this because apparently they were kind of angry at the mentor. It was not clear to me from her interview whether this was because of her or because they were angry at him about something else. And they voted her down for early tenure while simultaneously voting a male colleague who had about the same record in a positive direction for tenure. And so what she felt was her male mentor had not taken into account that they might view a woman faculty member coming up for early tenure differently than they did a man faculty member. And there is indeed quite a bit of research suggesting that if it's a field where there is not a large percentage of women and where the dominant stereotype of who is in the profession is a man, that for a woman to be accepted into that profession, she really has to be very good. She may have to overachieve or overprove herself. And so bringing her up for early tenure may not have been wise on this man's part. He was maybe thinking of what it would be like for a man. And since he didn't distinguish or discriminate, he assumed his colleagues wouldn't, and that wasn't really the case.
We have an email here from Skip who writes, the March-April American Scientist has a study of this topic. They report there are small differences between men and women without children in the mathematical sciences and that women are overrepresented in life sciences relative to their application rates. The factor that does make a difference in their career tracks is choosing to have children. Dr. Rosser's own experience seems to support this notion. What do you think about that?
Well, it does seem to make a very large difference in a couple of ways. First of all, I did study, as I mentioned, the Power Awardees, the Professional Opportunities for Women in Research and Education. I sent them an email questionnaire, and this was between 1997 and 2000, the four different cohorts, asking an open-ended question. What are the most significant issues, challenges, opportunities facing women in their careers? And they could say anything to that, negative, positive. In all 4 years, overwhelmingly the dominant issue was balancing career and family. I am now going back and repeating this some 10 to 15 years later, and in fact, I was working on analyzing some of those data this morning just before this radio conversation. And so I've asked those same questions again, and still the overwhelming issue for women faculty is balancing career and family. So that is definitely an issue. Now, in terms of the data showing whether it makes a difference if you have children or not in productivity. There is an old study by Zuckerman and Cole out of Columbia University that showed that up until if a woman already had gotten a toehold and was successful in her career and was at an elite institution, that number of children, unless you had more than four, didn't really make a difference. However, some newer studies, Marianne Mason's work out of Berkeley, suggests very strongly that women having children does decrease their possibilities of getting tenure and their publication rates, whereas for men having children, it does not.
Well, I wonder why, though, in this era when, you know, fathers are so much more involved in their kids' lives than ever in the past.
Well, the suggestion is that maybe they're not, at least for that period, or maybe they're not taking on that kind of work, or perhaps it's a perception issue in that, you know, tenure is judgment of one's peers. And so although we try, I think, as best we can, and there has been quite a bit of work to eliminate bias in that process, it's hard to say what actually goes into the judgment of quality.
So, Sue, what one of the things that I also want to talk about is you write about the fact that a supportive spouse or partner is more vital to a woman's success or can be in science than a great mentor. Can you speak to why that's the case?
Well, the reason I said that was that many, many women reported this in their interviews, that had it not been for a supportive spouse or partner, that they would not have made it. So the difference between having someone who actually does pick up the slack mm-hmm. and do half of the work at home, as you were suggesting, compared to someone who doesn't, would make a huge difference. You know, I had women who talked about that they were struggling to finish their PhD, and they had a commuter marriage, and so after the childbirth, maybe the first year, she kept the child, but then the second year, the husband kept the child in the city with him, and so she was able to finish her PhD, and she said without that, she really couldn't have finished the PhD. Or other people who talked about that they started their careers and they had a deal with their husband that whoever got the better job, they would go for that first, and then the next time it would be the other person's turn. But, of course, it doesn't usually work out that way. The way it usually works out is that whoever took the better job to begin with, assuming he or she performs well, then gets more opportunities than the individual who took the lesser career option. And so pretty soon the careers diverge more and more. And so a lot of women said, you know, my husband was willing to accept that, or he changed fields so that I could have this opportunity, and that made a really big difference to me. And then they would recount individuals they knew where it had not gone that way and how that woman had eventually dropped out of science.
So I don't know. I don't remember seeing a report on this in the book. Maybe you have anecdotal evidence. Is the most vulnerable time for prospective women scientists, I don't know, the years between 25 and 35?
Well, it's an interesting question that you ask, because what you're getting at is this whole crucial time of the competition between the biological clock and the tenure clock.
Right.
So often I'm asked, well, what is the ideal time if you're going to be a woman scientist to have children? And first of all, I don't think there is any hard and fast answer to that question, because it really depends tremendously on the individual, what kind of support system she does have, what her goals are, and so on. But let's take the person who sort of goes through on the traditional career track. So you get your you graduate high school at 18. Back in my day, you finish college at 22. Now that's often longer, right? Because people have trouble getting courses, or it seems to be, we talk now about 6-year graduation
right.
rates. So more people finish at 24, 25. Then you enter graduate school. Again, I got my PhD 4 years after I had gotten my undergraduate degree. But now most people, takes much longer for them to get their PhDs. So maybe they're, say it's 6 years, let's say by age 30 they get their PhD, which is not old at all these days for getting a PhD.
Mm-hmm.
Then they have to do a postdoc or two. And if these are a couple of years each, they're, by the time they get that first tenure track position, they may already be 35. And if they do wish to have children, that means that probably they're starting to think about that. But in that tenure track position, as you know, it's 6 years up or out. So that puts tremendous competition between the biological clock and the tenure clock. And there is quite a bit of research showing that many women scientists and engineers say either they deferred having children, they delayed having children, or they did not have as many children as they wanted to have.
I'm afraid we need to leave it there because we've run out of time. Suvi Rosser's new book is called Breaking Into the Lab, Engineering Progress for Women in Science. Sue, fascinating topic and discussion. Thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much. I've enjoyed it very much.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Joe Bellotti answers the phones. Christine McConnell produces the podcast. And our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about Think, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcast at kera.org/think. Comments, questions, and suggestions can be emailed to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.